Accession number 22066 Realty.
Edna Preston, Real 2. Yes, you were saying you had this reserved occupation in your jewellers.
Yes.
That had turned into these chronometers.
Yes, the watch, you see, it was a jeweller's shop, and at the back of it was a workshop with quite a number of watchmakers there. And they were doing this work on chronometers for the RAF, so I sort of had a reserved occupation. And I was there until March 43, when I suddenly got the call. You're not reserved anymore. You're called up.
You would have then been, if you were in London during those years, you would have been there during the worst of the Blitz, wouldn't you?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
I remember when I used to go fire watching every Sunday. I used to go fire watching to the jeweller's shop in Southampton Row. We were in a sort of set of three shops. I know it was Lyons, or was it Lyons Corner Shop or something, and a jeweller's. And I used to go fire watching with two of the other members of staff. And we used to have to go up on the roof and watch for incendiaries. I remember one day I had to walk to work because there'd been so much bombing in Rosebery Avenue that I had to walk from my home to Southampton Row. And as I'm walking along. Walking along Rosebery Avenue, there are flats on either side of Rosebery Avenue, big flats. And there were firemen, and there were great big hose pipes all over the road. And I remember tripping over these hose pipes, and one fireman said to me, "Where do you think you're going?" And I said, "I'm going fire watching." He said, "Well, you no need to go to Southampton Row, you can watch here." So I walked on. I walked on to Southampton Road and did my stint of fire watching. We used to have to sit on the roof and watch for incendiaries. And we got our stirrup pump, the three of us, you see. We knew how to work the stirrup. But I did that for some time. And I remember going to work one morning and I saw Mr. Saunders, our boss, waiting on the corner. And I said to him, "What's the trouble?" He said, there's a landmine. There was a landmine hanging on a building, on the corner of a building. It was just hanging there. And there'd been a bomb at the back of our shop. And, of course, the shop had been blasted. All the shutters were all billowing out. And it was a jeweller's. But nothing was taken, you know. Nothing was taken. So we stayed on for a couple of days clearing up the mess and getting glass put in and getting it sorted out. But you can imagine what it did to the businesses around there, being bombed there. And nobody was allowed through until it was on a parachute, this thing. And the parachute had got caught on the corner of the building. And I'm just standing looking at it. I don't think it really ever... Well, I that's when I said all through the war, if my name is on a bomb, then I shall get killed. We had a Morrison shelter in the end in our house. A Morrison shelter was like a huge iron table. And you got underneath it. You sort of all slept underneath it. And there was my family underneath this table. There was my mother, my young brother, my sister, her husband. I think they were married by then. And there they were with all their... They laid, instead of laying long ways under the table, there were so many of them, they had to lay with the other way round, with their feet sticking out. So, and in that room there was a put-you-up downstairs in this room. So I said, "Well, I'm sleeping in the put-you-up. I'm not sleeping in that under there and get my feet blown off. I'd rather get killed outright than have my feet blown off." Because there they were with their feet all sticking out the end, you know... of this Morrison shelter. And one day I woke up and the windows had been blasted and the bedclothes must have come up and all the glass went in and the bedclothes came down again because I woke up surrounded by bits of broken glass. But I never would go under that shelter. And that's how I was. I thought, well, if I'm going to get killed, I'll get killed. That's all I can say. And what was I, about 19, I suppose, 20? But it was... amazing, yes. Things we did, the things that we did in that war.
Yes.
Pack up every evening and go down the shelters. You sort of put your pyjamas on and you put a tracksuit over the top. and down the shelter you went with a push chair with your bits and pieces on it. And we used to go down to a big factory at the end of our road and into their shelters. They had some wonderful shelters there. And we had all the little children down there. We used to play games with the children. And I remember coming out one night when there was that terrible fire of London, when everything was ablaze. And as we came out of the shelter, I couldn't believe it. The whole sky was red. And I said to my mother, it looks as if London's really on fire. But we still went home after the all clear. Went home and got changed and off we went to work again, you know. We just seemed to carry on, you know, with the terrible things that happened. I remember going round one day to see my doctor, and his house wasn't there anymore. Fortunately, he was all right. He was all right, but there wasn't no house there. It had just been blown away. It was amazing. And we just sort of said, oh, where is he now then? And somebody would say, well, he's over, gone to some other number. So you would just go along, sort of thing, you know.
I suppose that life, did it become the sort of normal life,
yes,
in a way?
It did. It became a normal sort of life. It was amazing, really. People were so brave. I mean, I had a friend that was a warden, and he was out. He thought his wife was in the house, and his house got bombed. And there he was digging, thinking his wife was there, digging, and worried and trying to get to. And she wasn't there at all. And she'd gone out somewhere else. You know, people did terrible. You know, the things that we put up with, really, in London, and all those awful doodle bugs. And oh, they were. The doodle bugs were awful, really awful. Because I was in the Land Army then, you see, when the doodle bugs came over, and those awful V2s. I mean, you couldn't hear them coming. They just terrible explosion. I know, along where we lived, there was the church, and the Methodist. There was a Methodist church, and the young wife of the priest had taken the children across to the library, which was across the road, and they just got across to the library, all these children, when one of these awful V2s fell on it, and they just all disappeared, children and the wife of the dreadful things. But as I say, by then I was in the Land Army.
Yes, now we're going on to the Land Army. Well, thank you very much for telling me about your Blitz experience,
yes,
and how normal it seemed to you.
Well, that's all that I felt about it was, well, it's happening, and here we are, and if I'm to be killed, I shall be killed, and that's, if I'm not, well, try and do the best, sort of the best that you can.
I think it's particularly interesting in your case, because you're going to tell me later that you saw the bombing in Germany.
Yes.
And it would be very interesting to ask,
yes,
you about that later,
yes,
Edna.
Yes.
But now you're going to join the Land Army. Did you volunteer?
Well, I went along to Pentonville Road to the Labour Exchange to offer my services, as I'd been called up. Told them that I was a shorthand typist and where I'd been working. And they said, oh, yes. You can go off to a munitions factory in Scotland. Oh, I said, why Scotland? Why can't I get a job sort of down here? Oh, no, this is where you've got to go, to Scotland. So I said, well, is there anything I can volunteer for? So they said, yes, you can volunteer for nursing or the Land Army. I said, right, well, I'll volunteer for the Land Army then. Well, when I went up to Covent Garden, to Campstra, to see my old friends out there. Mr. Campstra owned a farm in Witten, in Huntingdonshire. And his son said to me, well, if you're going and join the Land Army, we've got a farm up there, which people owned it, but they had managers in working the farm, you see, the Tacky family. We'll see, go and work there. They'll want a Land Army girl. We'll get you a job there, which they did. They got me this job at this farm, which I thought was a great was very nice of them to do that sort of thing, you know, to get me in a job like that. So, and I was the only person there. So I joined the Land Army in March 1943.
And I was called up and joined. Sorry, I beg your pardon.
The name of?
The name of the farm.
The name, it was Manor Farm, I think. Manor Farm Witton.
That's W-H-I-T-T-O-N, is it?
W-Y-T-O-N. There was a big RAF, there's a big RAF station there at Witton.
And what part of the country was
Huntingdon.
It?
Huntingdonshire, Cambridgeshire. It was near Huntingdon, near St Ives. Oh, it was a lovely part of the country, beautiful. It was a beautiful part of the country. But a London girl going to be a Land Army girl, you can imagine the banter that went on. Because there was no young men working on this farm, they were all old chaps, you know. They called everybody Burr. Everybody was Burr. How are you, Burr? You all right, Burr? It was very, very funny. So I went and worked on the land.
Did they give you any sort of training or advice beforehand?
No, none at all. You just arrived there with your suitcase and your uniform.
Oh, what about
very smart uniform. We had breeches and we had corduroy breeches and very long socks and very stout brown brogue shoes and a very, very nice overcoat and a very nice hat. and we had green jerseys, but for working in we had dungarees and Airtech shirts and dungarees to work in. Oh dear, oh dear. So of course when I got there I had to get up at 6 in the morning, and she used Mrs. Tackey used me as a sort of maid come Land Army girl. I had to get their breakfast in the morning. I used to get up at 6 and get their breakfast. Before I went out to work, before I packed my lunch, my dockey, as it was called, I had a dockey bag with my dockey in it. But living on a farm, you can imagine, I was living off the fat of the land. I had ham sandwiches and because they were allowed to kill a couple of pigs, you see. And they had chickens. Lots of chickens that laid lots of eggs and lots of ducks that used to lay lots of eggs. But it was in a sort of arable farm. And also we had cows and we used to grow sugar beet, mangels, mangle wurzels, potatoes. But I remember we used to do chopping and singling of sugar beet. And I remember the men used to get so much a row, sort of 1 and 6 a row or something for sugar beet. And I used, at Land Army, I used to get 24 shillings a week, out of which I used to get stopped income tax, if you don't mind. I don't know, a couple of bob income tax out of there. 24 shillings a week and my board and lodging I got, you see. So when it came to chopping and singling sugar beet, the men said, they used to call me Emma, they never called me Edna. Well, if Emma's going to do chopping and singling, she can get the same as us. So Jeff Tackey, the farmer, said, no, she gets her wages, though they've all put their ducky bags down. I said, right, if she doesn't get that, we're not going to do it. So they insisted that every time they got money for these 1 and 6, and they Jeff said, she'll never keep up with you, because you had to, what you had a row, you sowed the seeds in a long row, then you had to chop out sort of 6 inches of plant and leave one, and then chop out and leave one. And it's very difficult when you've got this hoe and you're chopping, that she'll never do it. So one of the old chaps said, oh yes she will, she'll stop with us. So they slowed down with me to start with until I'd got the hang of it. So then I kept up with them and I used to get the same money as them, which was very good. When we went, they got a lovely orchard of plums, Victoria plums, and when we used to pick plums, they used to get so much a box for picking plums. So they insisted, right, I got the same as them. So if they got a sixpence for picking a box, I got sixpence as well. So they were very good. And they were old chaps, really old men, you know, real old farmers with bits of string round their knees, you know, their trousers and bits of string. But lovely fellows. And when I used to go home on leave, I'd walk through the village to the station, and as I would go along, these old chaps and their wives there would give me beautiful lettuces to take home to my mother and bunches of lovely flowers from their gardens. They were really, really wonderful to me while I was there. But of course we used to do haymaking because we only had horses to do everything, and I used to love the horses because we had two sorts of farms, a lower and a higher farm. When we went up to the higher farm, if I took Beauty up to the higher farm, I would unharness her at night, put a sack on her back, sit on her back and say, go home, and she would just go home. She didn't need any guiding. She knew exactly the way to go home. It was so those days were... I rather enjoyed those days.
Mm. How about the farmer's wife? You know, you were saying he was treated a bit like a
servant.
A maid.
Oh, no, it was the mother, Mrs. Tackley, that treated me like a maid. Oh, yes, she did. She treated me like a maid. But the funny thing was, the accountant from Mr. Campstra, who owned the farm, used to come every so often to check on the farm and to see to the accounts and everything, I presume. Of course, when he arrived one day, I knew him very well, the accountant. When he arrived, I had to have my meals in the kitchen, while they had their meals in the dining room. So, of course, he said, where's Edna then? Where's Edna then? So Mrs. Tackley said, oh, she's having them. What's she doing out there, he said. She should be sitting in here with us having a meal. Mrs. Tackley couldn't understand the closeness of us. He said, you do realise that Edna was Mr. Campster's secretary. So after that, I sometimes got invited into the dining room to have a meal. And I did. I joined the Women's Institute. Oh, yes, I joined the Women's Institute. I went along with Mrs. Tackley to that, and Mrs. Tackley adored Winston Churchill. She had his photograph on the wall, and she was a real fan of Mr. Churchill. And there's a little story that comes later when I went to work for the Foreign Office. She didn't know how I'd got into the Foreign Office, and I told her all about I lived next door to her dear Mr. Churchill. So she invited me back to the Women's. I went and stayed for a holiday with a friend of mine in the village, and she invited me to the Women's Institute to give a lecture on my Potsdam affair. So that was my years. But the thing was, we had to do haymaking and we had to do stacking. I mean, when we cut our corn, it was in sheaves, so you had to heap the sheaves up onto a cart and then heap them onto a stack and stack them. And I got terrible back trouble. I've got arthritis of the spine now. And I often wonder if that is the outcome. So I should get a war pension, really, shouldn't I? But I went to the doctors in London and he said it was fibrositis I'd got. And I couldn't walk properly. It affected my leg as well, which it still does now, affects my leg. But my arthritis does. And after I'd been in the land, I mean, nearly 2 years, my mother was getting a bit upset with being bombed and things. I went to my doctor and I said, is there any chance of me getting invalided out of the land army? And he said, yes. So he wrote me a certificate to send to the land army headquarters, and they said that was okay, I could leave. So I left. In 44, at the end of 44. So what happened then? I had to go along to the Labour Exchange, didn't I, in Pentonville Road, and report that I was no longer in the Land Army. What should I do now? So they looked at my records and said, oh, yes, we'll send you to a factory up in Scotland. So I said, excuse me. I said, I've been invalided out of the Land Army with back trouble, and you're going to send me off to Scotland now. Yes, that's where you would have gone before you joined the Land Army. So I said, oh, really? So the woman said to me, what sort of job would you like? So I said, I'd like your job, sitting behind there telling me where to go, which I thought it was a bit rude, but that's how I felt. I felt rather disgruntled about this. So she said I would have to go, and I refused. So she said, if I refused, they would take it further. I suppose I would have been imprisoned or something, you see. So I went home and I was discussing it with my mother, and my mother said, I know what we'll do. We'll write to our MP, Mr. Herbert Morrison it was. So I said, what do you mean? So, will you write and tell him what's happened, that you've been in the Land Army and now they want to send you up to Scotland? And she said, tell them that you're a shorthand typist, which I did. I wrote to Mr. Herbert Morrison's office and I got a beautiful letter back almost immediately from his office saying that they'd read my letter with interest and would I please go along to a labour exchange in the West End of London. It was at a certain time on a certain day, it had all been arranged for me, this appointment. Would I go along? So off I went to this new labour exchange. Oh, it was beautiful. It was all lovely armchairs and carpeted floors and a very nice lady said to me, oh yes, Miss Wyatt, do come along, you know, and sit down, and where have you been all this time? I said, what do you mean? So she said, you mean to tell me that you can do typing and you've been in the Land Army and now they want you to go to a factory? She said, we've been crying out for typists in government offices. She said, I just don't understand it. Apparently they said they did send memos round to all the labour exchanges explaining who they wanted. So why this one ignored it, I don't know. So when can you go for an interview? So I said, well, now if you like. So she said, well, I'll ring the office at the Foreign Office and see Mr. Lamb, who's in charge of staffing, and see what he says. So she gets onto the telephone while I'm there, and he says, Mr. Lamb, I've got a typist sitting here. And Mr. Lamb said, oh, wonderful, when can she come for an appointment? So I said, well, any time. So I made an appointment almost for the next day, and I went along for the appointment, and without any bother at all, Mr. Lamb said, when can you start? And there I am in the Foreign Office. All I had to sign, you had to sign letters of secrecy. And it was shift work. It was three shifts. All night. It was 10 till 6 and 6 till 10 and 10 till 6 sort of thing. And a nice little salary I was going to get, double pay for Sundays and time and a half for Saturdays if I'm working through, and so many weeks, days off. You work so many days on and then you've got 3 days off. I think we worked 10 days on and 3 days off.
You would have been a civil servant, really.
And
wouldn't
yes,
you?
This yes. was a civil, in the civil service now, and I had to sign a lot of papers, and it was in the communications department. And what happened was, all the information came through from the embassies, and the consul generals came into the coding office. All the coders deciphered all the messages. Then they came through to us for typing, and then they were sent all round to the members of parliament. And then we had a line through to Mr. Churchill's office. We had one of those special lines, you know, like a tube. We called it the tube, and you put your tube in it, went shush, and it's just its way off. Oh, excuse me. Yes, it was we had to type so many copies, you know, of the information that came through. We used to have to type so many copies, and each department had a different number of copies that we had to do. And we had to type them all on stencils, and they had big Roneo machines, and we had Roneo operators that used to Roneo all these off. So many copies, you know, and. Then they were all sent round to the different offices, but Mr. Churchill's was sent specially. And Mr. Churchill's, we had to do so many copies of Mr. Churchill's, and then we had to burn all the carbons and the top copy where we'd had to type it. And we had to make sure, because we had a supervisor sitting with us, and she used to watch us burn all the bits of, yes, we had to burn all the carbon papers. Very, very interesting. Get messages from all over the world, you know. The ambassadors used to send messages in. The consul generals, the offices from the different countries used to send all this in. It was quite interesting work.
And, of course, you would have seen the deciphered ones, wouldn't
we
you?
We would have seen the deciphered messages come through in writing that sometimes you couldn't understand the scribble of some of them. But I wasn't bad at deciphering scribble.
So, do you remember any? You know, did the messages, were they meaningful? to you.
Well, you got to the stage where you didn't know what the messages were. You just typed them automatically and it went straight over your head. Straight over your head. It would be what things are happening and what people are doing and what people are saying, and all sorts of messages would come in. And of course then we worked for Mr. Anthony Eaton. Oh, he was lovely. Well, you see, we didn't come in contact with anybody like that, but now and again Mr. Eaton would look in the door and smile at us all and sort of say hello and go. And one Christmas we were there working and his wife made us a cake and sent it down, and you know, because at Christmas we had to see, you had to work all the time. Christmases, it didn't make it much difference to us. But then I found that work very interesting, because you imagine there was a room full of us. I don't know how many there would be in a room, about 20, I suppose, and it's so many on each shift. And when you were on night duty, you had 2 hours in the middle of the night where you could go to sleep if you wanted. They had camp beds put up and blankets and you could sleep. But we used to go out. We used to go to Lion's Corner House. I remember we used to walk through the park from the front office. We could walk through the park out to the corner house. And we used to go in there and have a meal at 2 o'clock in the morning till 4. You see, we had a couple of hours off.
They were open right through the night.
Oh, yes, open through the night. Oh, it was full up. It was absolutely full up in the night time. It was amazing. We used to enjoy that with the walk through the park. And I remember from our offices, we used to watch, we could see into the square there, and if there was any parades going on or anything, we could always watch it. It was very interesting, really, working there. Really interesting.
To be in the Foreign Office building, what was that like, the building?
Oh, it was a wonderful building. It was a wonderful building. Although we were only in one section of it, we weren't allowed to really go into any other part of it, you know, in our... We had an office, and then there was a sort of quadrangle outside, enclosed it was, but we used to look out onto the other big buildings. It was lovely to work there. And when I used to get the bus from home, and I used to get off opposite Big Ben and then go home at night and stand at the bus stop and look at Big Ben, you know. It was really... And after working abroad, I thought I could have been here all the time. Could have been working there all the time.
If you were right in the centre...
In the centre of everything.
Of what was happening,
yes.
Weren't you?
Yes. I actually knew the war was going to end the next day. And I remember going home and looking at my mother and thinking, if only I could tell you, Mother, that it's going to end tomorrow. But I didn't. You know, I didn't, because I'd signed that certificate. And that's what I think about people these days in government that go telling stories about. I couldn't tell. I knew it was that Mr. Churchill was coming out in the morning with all his... And it was going to be over. And I never told my mother, and I was bubbling inside to tell her. I did, when it was all over and everybody knew, I said, yes, I did know, Mum, but I couldn't tell you. And she thought that was marvellous of me not to have told her. And I didn't. But you see, now I can't understand how people in government can go around giving out stories. I would have thought they all ought to sign this secrecy thing that I signed, saying that you mustn't tell. But there you are.
Did you ever have contact with Mr. Churchill, apart from your wishing?
No, not really, no. The only time we did, I remember, he lived next door to us when I was at Potsdam, when I was at the conference. He was in the sort of house along the road from us.
Yes, no, I was thinking in, you know, the Foreign Office.
No, we didn't have any contact with anybody like that.
But
Anthony Eden used to pop his head in now and again.
Was he respected as a foreign secretary?
Oh, yes, he was adored by us all. We all adored Mr. Eden.
What was he like, Anthony Eden? You know,
very, very, very suave gentleman, very, very well spoken. He was a real gentleman. He really was. Because then it came up about this Potsdam conference. And